This is Marcia Ripp, together with Chuck Coffey, July 16, 1986, for the Pittsburgh Chapter National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2, interviewing Hi Richmond. Hi, I wanted to ask you about your mother's full name.
Her name was Sarah Tobe, and Richmond was her married name. We were never clear as to the spelling as to whether it was T-O-E-B or T-O-B-E. Interestingly enough, one branch of a family that landed in Boston, Massachusetts, was named T-O-B-I-N by the customs inspector, which is an Irish name, I guess, as well. I think it means dove, but in Russia, I'm not sure.
Did your mother work at all when she was raising the children?
No. To my knowledge, she did no work at all. There was a certain amount of homework, I recall, when I was a youngster, where my dad would bring home pounds of tobacco, and the whole family would sit in the kitchen and pull the stems out of the leaves. Interestingly enough, that job was called stripper. And I think my dad was only working part-time in the cigar factories. They called them Toby factories. And it may very well have been that he was doing it either for the shop or for his own purposes. As a matter of fact, for the remainder of his life, he made his own cigars, as was the custom for immigrants who had worked originally in the shops.
You told us that you did not go to Hader, you went to something called the Shula. I wanted to know more about the Shula, what you did there.
Well, the Shula, and many of them still exist in New York today. One of the most famous ones is the Shula Malachim Shula in New York. These were Yiddish shulas. They taught writing and reading in Yiddish, and Yiddish was spoken there. This one was sponsored by the Workman's Circle, the Arbeiter Ring that we talked about in our prior session. They had a full-time instructor at that time. It was held on Miller Street in the Lower Hill, and we had a fair-sized class. One of my favorite stories about this that I can recall was that the tuition was $3 a week, and the teacher would put the letters on the board, the Buchstaben as they call them. We would copy them, going from right to left, and the instructor would come around and put some sort of a note on the sheet. My dad used to ask me how I was doing, and I thought I was doing well. And one day I brought the book home. My dad, who could read it, I hadn't learned how to read it yet, looked at it, and as the saying goes, "Hat im Gewohn, Finstel in der Augen," it became black before his eyes, and he said for $3 a week he should write not good. And I was able to read and write fairly well. I have forgotten both. I can recognize the printed letters, and this carried on because at least the verbal part carried on, and to some extent carries on today. I was a newsboy. I'm the last living newsboy that carried the Jewish Daily Forward. And I had quite a route. I had 90 papers. This was by which time I was in junior high school and then even high school. And I would have 90 some papers delivered to me every morning and would deliver them on the way to school. And these were people who got the paper every single day. After I quit, someone else carried it for a very short time, but because of the change in habits and the ability to read in Pittsburgh, they thereafter dropped that and went to a mail-in delivery, which made it one day late. See, when I delivered it, it would come in on the train from New York, just like the New York Times would today, and I would deliver it the same morning, and you had current news to actually compete with the local papers. But when it went by mail, it was always a day or two late.
Now, tell me about the Workman's Circle. What was it and how did it operate?
The Workman's Circle was a fraternal order for Jews, and it was one of many fraternal groups that were set up by immigrants. Most of these groups were non-Jewish groups. They would provide for some of the classic fears of the poor immigrants. One was a place to be buried. So they had a cemetery. In fact, there are two of them now out beyond Millville. They would also provide for sick insurance, so that if you were sick, there was some minimum income coming to your family. And, of course, there was some life insurance. It's interesting that these were the basic fears of the poor person, that he might live in poverty, but he at least wanted to have a decent burial. And they were almost burial society. They also had a philosophy which was heavily socialist in labor and nature. Now, interestingly enough, during the 20s, there was a philosophical split. These people were socialists, and the Communist Party was developing during that time. And there was real internal bickering and arguing about it. So that at that time, when you were called a right-winger, you were really a socialist, as we would define it today, having ideals which pretty much approximate the New Deal, which developed later on. If you were a left-winger there, then you were, of course, the communist wing. And as a matter of fact, I think they, for a time, even had a separate branch. There was a real internal battle. My dad belonged to the branch 45, which was the right-winger, more conservative of the two.
How did your father get involved with this? Was this a natural inclination, or did the labor movement carry him?
Well, I think the two went together. Almost everyone joined some society or organization. I don't know what his original motives were, and they may have been simply to have burial insurance and a place to be buried. But there was this philosophy, which was pro-labor. People who were prominent in the labor movement, such as David Dubinsky of the Ladies' Garment Workers, Sidney Hellman of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, were also associated with that same movement and belonged to it, were very active. The Jewish Daily Forward, which was the biggest Jewish newspaper, was also associated with its philosophy. Retrospectively, you would say they were almost New Deal, and although they called themselves socialists, they accepted a great deal of what we would call liberal capitalism.
You hinted at the regard for not having any derogatory statements against other Jewish groups in your household. Do you want to tell us about the sweat bath story that you had hinted at afterwards? You said that the Russians went to one sweat bath home.
Oh, you meant sweat bath, Schwitzfoot. Yes. As I said, a great deal of my earlier education, which I didn't realize and appreciate until I went to college, then found myself way ahead of other students in political science, economics, sociology, almost every area, was at these sessions that they held, not only on the streets, which were a literal Hyde Park. For example, on Saturday nights, if you went down Center Avenue on almost every street corner, there was someone holding forth for some point of view, and people would gather around. Sometimes they just stood there, or they'd have a stepladder, and they would climb up the ladder, and that would be their rostrum. But these sessions that I attended, I was going to say irreligiously, because these were Saturdays, would go on for hours at what was then Daniel's bathhouse. The story that I recall, because it has strengthened my belief in civil liberties and the rights of people with whom I don't agree, is this. My dad had a prime enemy whose name was Talisman, as I recall. I don't know what his English version of it was. They disagreed on everything. They spent all week preparing their arguments. Well, we came in one day and had paid our admission. I think it was 50 cents for my father, a quarter for me. And my father asked where this fellow was, and they said, he's sick. Well, we didn't even get undressed. We left, walked miles through the snow from the lower hill up to near Heron Avenue, where this fellow lived. We went in, and my father was very concerned. He asked how he was and so forth, and really worried about him. And as we came out, I said, Pop, I can't understand you. I said, the mildest thing you throw at this fellow every week is you wish he should drop dead, that he knows nothing and all that. And here, we paid our money, and we walked through the snow to his house, and you really cared about him. And my father turned to me, and the translation was, you don't understand. He's a fool, but he's my friend. And that has stayed with me over the years in protecting the rights of people with whom one emphatically disagrees. And I have this, I extend this out today, in the matter of civil rights and freedom of speech. And sometimes I get in trouble with my friends who don't want the plan of the Nazis to have a right to speak. And I can understand why they feel that way, but it'll even go that far.
Now, you mentioned you were on the debating team at Pitt.
Yes. This started, actually, I think it was a carryover from my younger years when I would engage in spirited discussions, being a member of clubs, the Irene Kaufman Settlement. I debated when I was in high school. I did public speaking when I was in high school. And when I went on to Pitt, I went out for the debating team and was made a member. This gave me an opportunity to broaden my view. I didn't realize how provincial I was. I think in the last session you asked me about my contact with others. Even areas like Oakland, East End, and Squirrel Hill were foreign territories. One knew very, very few people there. The only ones one knew from there were those who came down the hill to the settlement to be on the swimming team or to play basketball. But, for example, I was never even in the Y IKC until I went to college. Never in the building at all. Rarely went to Oakland. So it's interesting to look at the earlier provincialism. Then going to Pitt gave me a broader view because the team, I not only met people from all over, but the swimming team of which I was a member, the debating team, both traveled. So you had an opportunity to get out of the city and to go to places like Annapolis, New York, Chicago, places of that sort to compete. I had never been in the South in my life, and our debate tournaments would take us south. I never met people from abroad to any degree, and the British would send debate teams over here. As a matter of fact, one person with whom I debated was a young man named Stafford Cripps, who later on became Prime Minister of England. So there was this gradual expansion as one went out of the old neighborhood, and you could apply your concepts to bigger and bigger area.
Do you remember anything particularly memorable about any of the debates?
Well, I remember the one with the British, and I think it still carries today. If you listen to Margaret Thatcher and compare her ability to extemporize and speak so well, or an Abba Eban, who was British trained in nature, and wonder at how wonderfully articulate they are, I was impressed with that by the British. Of course, I was never quite sure what they were saying, but whatever they said very well. So, but it did expose you to other areas of the country. My first visit to a totally segregated college was with the Pitt debating team. And I remember that the coach, his temporary coach, was quite uncomfortable about that at the time, because I think when they arranged it, they didn't know it was a segregated black school. And the students were fed, believe it or not, one slice of processed American cheese for their meal. That's what we had, and tea. And it was a school in Tennessee, as I recall. There was some not too sure. I don't remember his name, and if I did, I wouldn't mention it. But that was in the 30s at the time. I think I mentioned last time that this pattern of discrimination was quite common in Pittsburgh well into the 50s here. We had many restaurants would not serve blacks.
Were you involved with the Pitt News at all?
No, not especially. I got a letter to the editor once in a while, but no.
Can you give me any background on the history of the labor movement here in Pittsburgh?
Well, some of it was personal, and in the sense of my family being involved, my dad being involved, and the rest of it was that as an observer. As a youngster, as I said, my dad worked in the cigar factories, and there was a cigar makers union. Samuel Gompers was the president of that union, and from that base he helped to form the American Federation of Labor. My dad could not believe that Samuel Gompers was Jewish, because he was a friend who would, according to my dad, would visit, come to the house when he visited Pittsburgh. The reason he didn't believe he was Jewish was because he spoke with a British accent, and all the Jews he knew spoke with Eastern European accents. He finally concluded that he had to be Jewish because, with anti-Semitism, no one would ever voluntarily try to pass as being Jewish. But the corollary of the labor movement, aside from bargaining for wages, hours, and conditions of work, was to have certain academic standards which still continue, so that, for example, the Ladies Garment Workers Union in New York and the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union have enormous adult education programs sponsored by the union or in conjunction with the schools. We had a version of that in the cigar factories here in Pittsburgh, and it was an almost spontaneous sort of thing. Invariably, these immigrant workmen, making no more than $4 or $5 a week on a piecework basis, would designate one of their number who would sit there and read from the classics, the newspapers, whatever. There was no radio at that time. And they would each give some of their cigars towards his income, just so they could, and they would study it. Now, this wasn't exclusively Jewish, necessarily. There were some Italian American shops on the Lower Hill. There were some Polish American shops over towards what is now Polish Hill or Lawrenceville. I don't have personal knowledge about that, but I just knew about these shops. Now, the interesting aftermath of that, there are two aftermaths. When I went to college and came home in my freshman year and discussed some Shakespearean play that we were handling in English Lit, my father corrected me. And I said, "Pa, how do you know about this?" He said, "Oh, we studied it in the shop." You see? So it gives you an idea of the depth of their interest. And of course, there were continual discussions. They were working with their hands, so they could always talk. There were wonderful disputations that would go on. Another story along that line in the family was that my uncle Ben, who then moved to Cincinnati and was the first Jew ever employed by the Southern Railway, was the union steward. And every Thursday or so, he would collect the dues. And there was a very pretty young woman who was always first in line to pay her dues. So they began to court and got married. No time for a honeymoon to go away, so they came back to work in a couple of days. The next time he collected the dues, she didn't get up. So he said, "What is this? You're always first in line to pay the dues. Now you didn't even get up." She said, "I wasn't interested in the union. I wanted you." The other story, there's a more recent one, which really moved me. About 6 years ago, I went to Israel on a history group trip, and we had this was composed entirely of labor people from various American unions, and I was with them because of my interest and because I'm a neutral in the field. And we started talking about this reading in the shops. And this one fellow from the Retail Clerks Union, which has now absorbed the Cigar Makers Union, said, "Now I understand it. Even today, where they have a unionized shop, there is a provision in the union contract that the employer, upon the request of the employees, is required to provide a chair for use by a reader should the employee wish to employ him for study and discussion." And that's in their contracts today. And he didn't realize it, because the workmen in the shops today are solidly non-Jewish. They're heavily so, I guess, in Florida, whether Hispanic or Black or Italian, perhaps, Italian-American. And they still preserve that, this association. So the early movements, the labor movements, and this extended also to other non-Jewish groups as well, and that is that there was an association with other things, insurance, social protection, social legislation in the Congress, self-learning. Keep in mind, these were immigrants that had to put in 12-hour days. If they had any strength left, they might go to Americanization and a few other classes afterwards. I think you have the same experience today, maybe with the Russian immigrants or something.
Now I want you to tell me about your own experience in enforcing the minimum wage and hours in the sweatshops.
Well, this was kind of an accidental dream come true. During the 30s, while I was going to school, I was interested in labor. It was the time of the CIO and all the excitement of it. I remember, for example, going down to the J&L plant on 2nd Avenue and helping to pass out leaflets for the steel workers who were trying to organize them. And I got hit on the head by a guard because the company didn't want it, and I didn't duck fast enough. And so I was there during all this excitement. And while I was going to college, I was torn two ways. One was to take any courses that would get me a job, and as a result, my undergraduate work was a hodgepodge. It was, in a sense, pre-law, it was pre-teaching, it was pre-social work, it was pre-anything that would get you a job, because my dad was working very little during that time. I think that looking at his Social Security record from 1935 to 1940, he earned $1,900. So things were pretty tough during that time. And I pretty well had to get through as fast as possible and get to work. But my interest in labor was there, and I took every possible civil service exam, from liquor store clerk to wage hour investigator. Lo and behold, I did quite well on that exam and was called in. I had meanwhile had a couple of jobs that I think I mentioned, working as a playground supervisor for 1 year and working for the relief board for a while. So that I started there in March 1941 and was assigned to Erie. At that time, the minimum wage was 25 cents an hour. It was time and a half over 44, and it gradually went down to 40. We had a backlog when I started of complaints that were up to 3 years old. The law was passed in 1938. So that sometimes when we would come to businesses, they had been long gone, or the complainant had died or moved away. And I worked out of Erie until 1942 when I went into service. When I came back from service in 1946, I worked out of Pittsburgh. However, the Erie area was much lower wage than even Pittsburgh, and it was very common to find people being paid 12, 15 cents an hour at that time. I remember going into a light bulb factory that no longer exists in Warren, PA, and being castigated because I was forcing them to increase their wages from 18 cents to the minimum wage of 25 cents an hour. And here were rows of women assembling these light bulbs before they went into some sealing mechanism. Wages were abominable. I found wages as low as 7, 8 cents an hour.
some about which I could do nothing, because at that time, for example, that was the great barrier of the country. Well, not the great barrier, one of the major ones. And the migrant workers would come in. I had a chance to see how miserably they lived, but there was no federal jurisdiction. The irony of the law was that originally it did not apply to the people who needed it most, people who were retailing service industries, hospitals, nursing homes, organizations of that sort. Later on it applied. So the migratory workers had no coverage at all until really the 1960s. This was because of various pressure groups trying to have people under or not under the law. So that it was a very satisfying job in terms of visible evidence of what you were doing. You were doing something to raise income and purchasing power and standards for these involved families. And it was pretty solidly that. You ran into things which you only read about now. For example, I had a public utility company which was paying very poorly. They were paying well over 25 cents an hour, but their employees would work long hours, many of them unpaid. And they had one of their people actually following me. I used to have my hotel room visited and my briefcase was broken into. I had to actually carry all my material in my car. I would go into a city where I would routinely get tags on my car simply because I was that communist, in quotes, who was enforcing that Soviet-inspired law. And I remember in one city I went in and the police chief told me that he'd been told by the plant supervisor that he was to tag the hell out of me until I got out of town. So it was exciting, and as a young person, one thrives on that. I don't know how well I can do today. It was a very exciting time. Now, after I came back from service, keep in mind that we had the war in the interim. We had a huge labor shortage, enormous increases in wages during that time, and the strengthening of unions, which had done well in the mass industries in the 30s, but didn't really do well until after World War II. So from that point on, we still had some of these conditions, but not as much as before. There were exceptions. I ran into one thing right out of East Liberty in Pittsburgh, where there was an outfit that was making what is euphemistically known as carny crap. These were these cheap lamps and statues that you see at carnivals now, but would be bought by lower income people, the traditional swans and so forth. And I remember going in there, there was a young couple who had recently come from Italy, who could hardly speak English at all, and had been hired because in Italy they are very well versed in casting and that kind of artwork, although at a better quality rate. And here was this couple. The woman was just all covered with plaster Paris and all that, and yet looked beautiful, as Italian actresses do, no matter how they're dressed, you know, rugged and basically nice. This couple was being paid $21 a week for a 68-hour week. 21 for both of them, see. And the employer said, well, I'm letting them off 2 hours on Wednesday afternoon to go to an Americanization class. And I said, where do they become Americanized and realize that that might be passable for Sicily, but not for Pittsburgh, you see. So we did run into exceptions of that nature. And over the years, it's been satisfying to see that, by and large, labor standards have been pretty good. As a matter of fact, the areas which typify what I saw in these earlier days are primarily in the remote south and along the Mexican border. Many of the garment factories that moved out of New York and Philadelphia into the Pennsylvania Highlands, then moved south and moved into lower Texas where they use wetbacks and may not even appear on payroll. Now, part of my experience after World War II involved going into the area around Johnstown, Somerset, and nearby areas. People don't realize how much of the garment industry moved from New York and Philadelphia to that area to get away from unions. And they did have sweatshop conditions, which did improve because the union essentially came out. Mike Johnson, who was recently retired, he was a member of the Public Utility Commission and previously was one of the officers of the state AFL-CIO, who was an organizer for the Ladies' Garment Workers Union. And these were New Yorkers who came to places like Johnstown during the Depression, where there was absolutely no work for women and very little for men, and employed them.